All righty, if everybody would take your seats and get ready, we'll bring the meeting to order the Public Safety and Security Policy and Finance Committee and start out with a roll call. Representative Cornish, here. Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Becker Finn.
Here.
Representative Considine.
Here.
Representative Dean. Representative Frankie.
Here.
Representative Grossel.
Here.
Representative Howe.
Here.
Representative Romer. Representative Lucero. Representative O'Neill.
I'm here.
Representative Pinto. Representative Ward.
Here.
Representative Zerwis.
Okay, quorum present, and who wants to approve the, give a motion to approve the minutes from January 17th?
I'll do it.
All right, Representative Considine makes a motion to approve the minutes of January 17th. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay. Motion passed. Who we have? We have the Department of Corrections. Mr. Roy, Commissioner Roy. Welcome, sir. Morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Just to start off with, maybe you have it in your presentation today, but I'd like members, before we start grilling the commissioner with questions about segregation, to have him make a presentation on it first, a kind of an update, what was in the papers, how you're handling it, what we look like with the nation, the program that you're starting into. I mean, during whenever you want to, if it isn't in your presentation, if you could add it at the end. That way, otherwise, we're going to get 5-6 questions on it, and it'll delay, maybe take care of some of the questions if you hit it before we.
Mr. Chair, we will attempt to weave some of that discussion into our presentation. However, the details are best delineated in our white paper that we produced, and I'm not sure that all members have received that white paper. It is currently on our website. We would gladly return to do a very detailed review of that with you on a future date, but we will attempt to get to some of those issues today as well.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner. Go ahead. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you're talking about segregation, you're talking about solitary confinement, correct?
Right, but that the new politically correct word is segregation.
Oh. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Or restricted, whatever. We all talk about the same thing, just in different terms. So.
Mr. Chair, committee members, it's good to be back before you. And some of you have seen parts of this presentation. New members, I look forward to conversations with you about the business we do and the important work we do. We've crafted this 32-slide presentation to give you a pretty comprehensive overview of who's walking in our doors, who is leaving our facilities, and who is being supervised in the community. First of all, though, I'd like to introduce Deputy Commissioner Terry Carlson to my left. She is in charge of all of our facilities. Deputy Commissioner Ron Solhide is in charge of our community's supervision division, formerly called probation and parole. And each of these deputies will have a portion of this presentation. I will lead off with this first slide, and I think some of you may have remembered our first slide always showed a big granite building in St. Cloud. And as we were looking at putting a title on this presentation, we realized that we are more than buildings, that we are really about people and the people that work for us and the people that we care for and try to change in our facilities. We are always driven by our mission, and that mission is to reduce recidivism by promoting offender change through proven strategies during safe and secure incarceration and effective community supervision. Really what that boils down to is we have to do our best to prevent future crime and future victimization. We are postured fairly positively around the country. We are the 49th lowest in state general fund expenditures on corrections at 2.7% of our general fund. The national average is 6.8%. We're the 47th lowest in correctional staff associated with our workforce at 5.2. We have a large workforce, obviously, because we have such an important mission at 4,300. The third bullet relates to the ratio, and this is a Pew Research ratio that they delineated in their 1 in 100 report, and they laid it out all 50 states to indicate to policymakers that large expenditures on corrections can impact other important areas of work. So our ratio is for every dollar on higher ed, we spend 17 cents on corrections. Some states, that ratio is reversed. For instance, Vermont spends $1.37 on corrections for every dollar spent on higher ed. And it, for states that have high populations, it can be a tremendous drain on state resources. And we're also very proud of the fact, and we'll get into some detail about the programming we have in prisons and the positive effect that that has. Some of you have seen this slide before. This shows the four states that have a larger population immediately above us and the five states below us with the actual 2015 census numbers. And to the right is really the important column. You will see similarly situated states with 2 to 3 times as many people in prison. And Wisconsin has almost identical demographics with us in terms of crime rates, in terms of population economics, but they have chosen a different model of corrections. They have more than twice as many prisons, and they don't have as a robust community correction system as we have.
Representative O'Neill has a question, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought I would ask now instead of at the end and pull it back. Just a really quick clarification question. I know we have kind of this, we talked before about the six-month churn, and so we have people returning to prison. Maybe in one calendar year they might have 2 stays. We'll just, I'm not sure what you call it exactly, but 2 visits to the prison. And so this calculation, is this by individuals or by trips into the prison system?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, this actually is a snapshot of total population, so it's a capacity. It's not a return, repeat number. So on any given day, these are the number of people in prison.
Thank you.
Commissioner Roy, one thing that I always wondered about, I don't know if you've wondered about, but the incarceration rate. We always brag about being the second to the bottom in the or second lowest nationwide, but when does it get to be alarming when you're at the bottom? In other words, every time you see something lately in the paper, you hear somebody's convicted, near released, convicted, released, convicted, released, and then my relatives that receive these violent offender notices on their mobile display terminals and their squad cars released into the community with numerous convictions and warning about violent offenders. And just today in the paper, I see a guy that was in the Minneapolis paper, numerous convictions and back on the street. So when is it a good thing to be in the lowest when you weigh it against these people turning up in the streets and the cops complaining that they're dealing with these same people? Would it be better if we were 25 instead of second?
Mr. Chair, we have many missions, and one of those missions is to incapacitate offenders. And when we turn the key on the cell door, that's incapacitation. You will see some future slides here that indicate that 95% percent of our offenders, we turn the key the other day, other way, and the door is open. So in addition to incapacitation, we also have a mission of rehabilitation and trying to get them to be non-repeating offenders. And when we talk about recidivism reduction, and you'll see some examples of programs that we use to reduce recidivism, we feel there's a good return on investment by doing that. But you have correctly stated the issue of at what point do we give up, and do we say this person needs to be incapacitated for a long time, and at what point do we provide programming to that person knowing that they're going to get out? So it's an alarming thing. I'm as alarmed as you when I see those morning newspapers and the accounting of crime. That's driven me for 42 years to do a better job, and I will continue to do my best to make sure people don't return.
And I'm not saying, Commissioner, that I have any solution for it either, or any silver bullet, or what the best rating would be. It's just the frustration that I'm hearing. You know, I just kind of wonder what your thoughts were. Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you may want to talk about this at some other point, but I didn't want to lose, as long as we're kind of bringing up concerns. In terms of this population and comparing to other states, do we also have a comparison with what happens at the county level? Because I'm hearing from my counties that there's a lot of stress in terms of their capacity and feeling like the state is pushing offenders to them to take care of, and it's really stretching them a lot. So if at some point that would be appropriate to bring in, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, actually that discussion will be a bit in the future here.
Okay. All right. Go ahead, Commissioner.
So even having a small department on a national level, it still costs a lot to provide correctional services. We are a heavy general fund department, and the main divisions are represented here. But we are pleased to say that 95 cents of every dollar goes to direct services. We have only 5% operation support. We have a relatively low budget, as previously stated, comparatively with other states, but we still are a pretty significant presence in the state budget. This gives a historical look at our current prison population by year, and this again is a snapshot. We will be talking in a bit here about the reasons for this, but I think it's important to note that there is an upward trend, but it is leveling out to a degree.
Commissioner, is this the upward trend that caused some concern the previous sessions we were at, you were talking about?
We will attribute the upward trend in two more slides very specifically.
All right, thank you.
So this is another representation of the trend, but I think the important thing for you folks to look at is the footnote, which shows that these projections have changed with the result of the 2016 drug reform that happened last year. We are always a bit reticent to talk and say these are exactly the numbers that you will see in the future, but we have a pretty good feel for our projections as being pretty accurate. We've worked with the Sentencing Guidelines Commission on these projections, and they are optimistic, but I think pretty significant in the impact over the course of years. Deputy Carlson will talk about this slide, which talks about the number of individuals that are not in our prisons but are currently in county jails.
So, Mr. Chair and members, my name is Terry Carlson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Facilities Division. As you can see on this slide, the blue line is the actual population of offenders who are housed in county jails who actually have been committed to the Commissioner of Corrections, and they're housed in county jails because we don't have room within our prisons. You can see that that blue line has kind of gone up and down. We've had as many as just over 500 in our county jails being boarded, and right now we're at about the 300 mark.
This has driven much of the discussion over the past couple of years, the use of county jails. There have been a number of proposals on how to address the overpopulation issue, and we will talk about in a bit here our strategies that have brought these numbers down, and we are hopeful that this number will continue to trend downward.
Commissioner, I got a question from Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a really quick question. Are we still paying $62 per day per prisoner to house them in a county jail?
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, it's a $55 a day per diem.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. So, for members to know that prison beds in Minnesota are reserved primarily for the largest population of person offenders, and those person offenders are serious felony assault, criminal sexual conduct, robbery, and the sentencing guidelines drives who comes to prison. And the sentencing guidelines, I think you have a presentation next week on the guidelines, and the guidelines were formed to give added weight to person offenses, recognizing that prisons really are for people to be protected, and people have said that you shouldn't necessarily send people to prison that you're mad at, that there's better strategies for that. So clearly, people with person offenses come to prison and they serve a longer time as well. Chair Cornish, this gets to the previous discussion, slide number 10, about the prison, why our population has risen so much and why the trend has been upward. This graph represents the prison population in 2000 to 2015. And the crimes that are listed below are crimes that have been enhanced or are been new statutes within the criminal code. So sex offenses have been enhanced, increased homicide sentencing, felony domestic abuse basically didn't really exist in 2000, stalking crimes, anything around domestic abuse has been enhanced pretty much. You can see the meth crimes pretty significant, property crimes not so much, but I always focus on the felony DWI as a perfect example of a new statute that has significantly impacted prison populations. There were none in 2000. There are now around 700 felony DWI offenders in our prisons. That is basically half a prison. And that statute, I'm not putting any qualitative emphasis on whether that's a good law or a bad law. I'm just saying it's the law. And this is the impact that a law has on prison population. We've seen some enhanced weapons offenses, and for sex offenders and predatory offenders, failure to register is a felony as well. But those changes from 2000 to 2015 have added about 4,000 beds to our 10,000 beds. So that's a pretty significant increase in 15 years, and hence we are where we are today in terms of our population issue. Even with that increase, however, this is another look at how we compare with the country, and this particular map is pretty significant in that it shows our prison incarceration rate per 100,000 of civilian population. And in Minnesota, 196, the United States average at 458. So the blue states and the circled states are the lowest, and the red states are the highest. And as you can see, the states on the other end of the Mississippi River are pretty significant in the number of people that they have incarcerated. There's a particular prison in one of those states that has about 6,000 individuals in that prison. 95% of those people will die in prison. They will never get out. And when you have a life population like that, obviously your incarceration rate goes very, very high. So we saw a positive map that we just looked at. This chart represents the states with the highest growth rate. And you can see Minnesota is in that high 10. And this graph directly relates to the previous slide, or the slides before showing the new 15-year growth. And our numbers are small, but the percentage because of that is pretty high. And there are many states we don't have that we show here, but there are many states that are on the decline in terms of their prison population, including some very large southern states like Texas.
So to deal with prison population, we've employed a number of strategies. And in a slide or two, I'll go through with a little more detail the bonding request to add beds to our facilities. Also, the sentencing guideline reform for the drug offenses has had an impact. Utilizing non-DOC facilities where possible, we're contracting, like I said before, with 18 counties for jail bed space, and that has helped us tremendously. We've revised internal department policies for revocations and violations, specifically length of time that people may come back to prison once if they violate their conditions of release. Also, we're using community resources more for community support, and we believe that that has a strong impact on recidivism reduction. And we also have studied the feasibility of adding a smaller 100-bed unit onto existing campuses, either within a secure perimeter or as a minimum custody kind of unit, as another way to deal with our bed increases, because we certainly know that expanding on existing campuses is less costly than a whole new infrastructure.
Representative O'Neill has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence. Just a quick question. You had talked about technical violations returning, causing the recidivism rate. Do you have a breakdown of what percentage of those returning through are technical violations or new crimes committed?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, we have a graph that will show some of that. There is detail. We're currently in a major research project that shows the reasons for violation, where those violators come from, the conditions that they're violating, and we hope to develop strategies around those specific characteristics.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. I'll look forward to that conversation as we get into that about the technical violations and how many are returning to prison because of technical violations, and what can we do about maybe having a different path than sending them back to the prison for, like, a dirty UI or something.
Okay, thank you. Commissioner.
This is just a slide to give you an overview of what our bonding requests were last year and are again this year. Three of these projects increase bed space in our facilities, and asset preservation certainly is always needed for our aging facilities.
Thank
This slide shows the location of our prison facilities and also gives you a snapshot of when the facility was built and the current capacity.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I would draw your attention to St. Cloud, Red Wing, and Stillwater. We call those our turn-of-the-century facilities, and it's amazing to me to consider that those facilities have functioned over this course of time nonstop, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. So when we talk about state facilities and squeezing out usage, believe me, we have squeezed out the usage. And then to focus on Faribault and Moose Lake, converted state hospitals. So we have maintained those facilities. We're proud of their condition. But believe me, when you start maintaining a 100-year-old facility, the infrastructure needs can be pretty significant. And we have been identified as the highest state agency with deferred maintenance needs. The Department of Administration has done a study. We're holding our own. I was going to use the words of the captain of the Edmund Fitzgerald, but I probably shouldn't do that. We're holding our own. We're in good shape. We don't have a roof's caving in, but we certainly have some needs.
Commissioner, do you run into any problems with SHPO? Because they're so old, are any of these prisons historical that you have to go past the State Historical Preservation Officer?
Mr. Chair, you will see one of our requests is the granite wall perimeter restoration. It's the second from the bottom. That wall has been identified, and for those who have seen the wall, it's pretty darn impressive, but it is also aging, and the tuck pointing is in terrible shape. This is the first phase of a very expensive restoration, and the historical folks have delineated the requirements for tuck pointing. We actually have to use historical methods.
Representative Hilstrom had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me about the change at Togo and what it is, what the capacity is now, who you're sending there, and what you believe the capacity to be throughout this year?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilstrom, thanks for that question. The mission changed at our Togo facility. It used to be juvenile boys and also women challenge incarceration program. A year and a half ago, we ended the juvenile program and made it an only adult male program. We started out with challenge incarceration program and some minimum, and then we switched it over to all challenge incarceration program men. The capacity at that facility right now is 75, and we are needing some funding through our bonding request to deal with some of the wastewater issues, the septic system. And so we believe that that capacity can go up to 90, possibly even a bit more, but 90 is pushing it on the campus without another major building project. Yeah, I think that's it.
Okay. Commissioner, go ahead.
So we have a classification system within our prison system that identifies the custody level of our facilities and then matches that with the custody level of our offenders. So maximum custody, the building standards and barriers are different than, for example, at our medium custody, and our practices within our facilities of movement of offenders and how they get from place to place differ based on custody level as well. As you know, our Shakopee facility is the only facility for women, and so that houses all security levels of offenders.
Mr. Chair, this might be a good time for Deputy Carlson to discuss our restrictive housing strategies and how those currently exist in our facilities.
Okay, Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity. It is a national issue that we're looking at restrictive housing. Some people call it segregation. Some people call it isolation or solitary confinement. The new term is really restrictive housing. And it's about those offenders who are living in our facilities who are not abiding by rules, are violent people who are assaulting other inmates or staff members. And we have a unit at most of our facilities where these people are housed so that the rest of the population can program safely in the facilities. Throughout the last year, we have made some significant strides towards changing a variety of things within restrictive housing, including the length of time that people would serve for violations within our facilities. We do have a major reduction up to 90 days for the most violent offenses. It used to be that people could spend a year or more in segregation for those types of offenses, assaults, serious assaults. And so that has been in effect since September, and we continue to study violence levels in our facilities and the number of assaults that happen. And over the course of these months since September, since those changes were made, we have not seen a significant uptick in levels of violence. So that's really good news because, you know, safety is our big thing. We want our staff who are working in these facilities, and we want the offenders who are doing their time to be able to do that in a safe way. And so the shortening of that time in restrictive housing has happened already. We are working on plans to increase programming, but that comes with, you know, we need additional staff to help with that programming, and it would be programming that's evidence-based to show that it reduces levels of violence and reduces an offender's risk to recidivate, cognitive skills training, more intensive behavioral health training for certain offenders. So getting offenders out of their cells for longer periods of time is another strategy that is being employed throughout the nation for our restrictive housing initiatives. Again, that is a staff-intensive venture because when you move people from their cells, if they're violent, you have to restrain them properly and move them to a new area to do their recreation. Used to be that those offenders would get about an hour out of their cell a day, and we're working on ways to expand that and also to bring programming, bring education, programming, and other therapists into those units to provide the needed service for those offenders so that they can be reintegrated back into our facilities and have a better likelihood of success upon release. We're also paying very close attention to those offenders who would be released to the community from our restrictive housing units and working to decrease that. And when those inmates are still violent in our facilities, we'll bring programming and information to them. Otherwise, it's trying to get them out for that kind of transition and release preparation.
I suppose you naturally have to balance the people who are after you about social justice reform and against the guards that are getting their face punched in. So trying to find the balance in between. Representative Considine had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you care to hazard a guess as to the percentage of that population that have mental health issues?
Mr. Chair, Representative Considine, I have said in front of this committee that if we use a broad description, like you just said, mental health issues, I would say the vast majority of individuals currently in our prisons have some issue related to mental health, whether that's chemical dependency or more significant mental health issues. But the very serious mental health individuals are in our mental health unit at Oak Park. And they sometimes go between our two units, and those are the most serious people we have at Oak Park, that we see that population often goes from mental health unit. We try them back into population, and then they may go back into SEG. So it's a very difficult population to deal with and very staff intensive, and they can be very violent. And Chair Cornish's comment about staff safety is an extreme concern for us with those individuals, and we will always staff safety will always trump our decision making.
Representative Hilstrom and then Representative Dean.
Got a follow-up.
Oh, follow-up. Go ahead there, Representative Constant.
Thank you. Representative Cornish. So would I be correct then in saying that without additional resources for mental health treatment, a lot of these people will not get much better when you're trying to reduce violence?
Mr. Chair, Representative Constantine, we believe that treatment should be given to these folks and everybody that needs it in all of our facilities. But this particular group that you described and I described is very staff and labor intensive, and we do require additional staff to do that. And when our budget is discussed in future days, it will have some notion related to that.
I'm also very invested in staff safety at these institutions. Thank you.
Representative Hilstrom and then Representative Dean.
Thank
you. O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Can you please kind of walk us through how you decide? I assume you have segregation at all of your prisons.
With the exception, Mr. Chair and Representative, with the exception of our Togo facility and at, well, Red Wing
Willow,
has,
Willow.
At Willow River, yeah.
Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner, then, how do you determine whether you're going to increase the custody level of the person versus sending them to segregation for long periods of time? How do you make that determination?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, I'm going to defer to Deputy Carlson, but I will say that it's not often an either-or, that classification level between prisons might not change and usually doesn't.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hilstrom, that's correct. Especially for offenders who are at medium custody, where there's, like at our Moose Lake facility, there's limited opportunity to even lock someone in a cell because of the physical layout. If someone ends up being extremely violent at that facility, they may get a segregation or a restrictive housing sentence, and they also may go up to a higher custody facility. The same holds true with our Lionel Lakes and our Faribault facilities. The open campuses, the access to movement is less controlled, and there's just more freedom for offenders and a lot of spaces that people can get into. So if people are consistently breaking rules and are very violent and creating security problems at our facilities, we will move them to a higher custody level facility. And the staff at those either close custody facilities or our maximum custody facility will work with those offenders to help step them out of a restrictive housing setting into more and more programming opportunities at that higher custody level. And that's why it's really important for us to have programming at all of our facilities.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the question is, do you have any folks at the lower level custody status that then have long periods of time in segregation? And do you make the trade-off to make certain that that doesn't happen by simply moving them to a higher custody status?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, the levels of violence that would have someone get a longer segregation sentence occur less frequently at our medium custody facilities. So really the longer segregation sentences, the longer restrictive housing placements, are at our close custody facilities and at Oak Park Heights, although I have to explain that at our St. Cloud facility, which is our intake facility, they don't have a big segregation population at that facility either. People are going through the orientation process and generally get moved out to their appropriate placement, so they don't have the same issues that our Rush City, Stillwater, and Oak Park Heights facilities are. That's where we're focusing our efforts the most for our restrictive housing reform.
Thank you.
Hey, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. When we're talking about isolation and separation, I think there's currently a lot of evidence-based practices out there about what is that balance, because if you keep someone in isolation, they actually become a greater risk to staff and a greater risk to injuring themselves as well. So have you all been looking at a lot of the things that have been done throughout the country relative to reducing not just the number of people that actually go into a segregation unit, but also reducing that time and the services that are associated? Because, you know, I agree with, my colleague, Representative Considine, that safety should be a big concern for staff, but I know that the practices in the past have actually probably been making it more dangerous for staff as well. So could you speak to that?
Commissioner or Deputy, either one.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, so yes, we are looking at not only the number of people who go to restrictive housing, reducing that, reducing the time that they would serve in totality for a violation, also adding in more out-of-cell time so that there's more community opportunity for those offenders and the detrimental impacts of that isolation are reduced. And I just had a thought, and it just left my head. Commissioner, sorry.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, we've done major collaboration with national organizations as well, and we just received a grant for some consulting related to that. We've done an external study about 18 months ago, and I regularly meet with other commissioners in states that have a year or two ahead of us on some of these initiatives. And actually, I'll be seeing some of those folks tomorrow, and on our agenda is a continued talk about restrictive housing. It's a national discussion right now, and the results of those states who have been very aggressive in reducing the numbers in isolation. The staff safety numbers are, as you have noted, pretty positive, that you don't see a huge spike as a result. But I am always cautious when we start comparing Minnesota, because our numbers are so small already, that maybe they have removed their low-hanging fruit. And even the commissioner from Colorado has said every state will have a restrictive housing unit for the most serious offenders. That's just the reality of our business. If an offender stabs a staff member or another offender, 60 days or attempted murder, even though they're in prison, there has to be a consequence. And sometimes it's sad to say, but the only consequence is separating them from other population. We're going to be very discretionary, though, in how we approach that. This particular slide.
Representative O'Neill had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's along the same lines of what Representative Considine was talking about. Instead of using the term having a mental health issue, maybe the severe and persistent mental illness, where they're actually in need of a psychotropic drug or other medication to manage their illness. And I understand you've got those that maybe committed homicide outside and now they're doing the same thing inside, or there's gang activity and there's planful and devious activity. And if we put that aside and those that are that have a temporary instance where they're violent because of the severe and persistent mental illness, and I'm assuming you would also put them in isolation for a time, but there's got to be a fulcrum point where the time of letting them kind of cool down and kind of decompress, there's a benefit to that. But then you get to a point where they also, if they're there too long, begin to decompensate and their mental illness is more severe. And so I think that's sort of the segment of folks that we're kind of thinking about in the discussions around the table. We understand the other, where they are planning and devious and, you know, they've committed heinous crimes outside and they're continuing to commit heinous crimes inside. That's a different segment. But those that are temporarily violent because of their severe persistent mental illness, they get put in isolation. I think those are the folks we're kind of concerned about the most, because they would further decompensate if they were in isolation for an extended period of time. And maybe you can help tease out which is which. Do we know which ones are actually, you know, in the decompensation side as opposed to they were committing heinous crimes outside and they're going to continue it inside?
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, a little over 10% of all of the offenders in the Department of Corrections have serious and persistent mental illness. And of our segregation population, that makes up 11% of our segregation population. So it's pretty low. Those people are identified, and our behavioral health workers are aware when those offenders are involved in levels of violence that would bring them to the segregation unit. And oftentimes those are men who are at our Oak Park Heights facility as well. And so the mental health unit is right there. And as the commissioner was describing, there's a lot of back and forth from the mental health unit and also our restrictive housing. So we agree with you that that's an important population to pay very close attention to.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, I think it's important for people to understand, too, that even at the highest level of restrictive housing, we just don't turn the key and say, see you later. We have eyeballs on those people all day long.
Every half hour.
Mm-hmm. We have mental health staff checking in every day.
Nursing staff several times a day.
And the description of that has been played out in some sources is an extreme description that I can very confidently say does not exist in Minnesota.
It must be a troublesome decision for you, like a judge letting somebody off on a sentence into the community. The community turns out to be the guinea pig, and you have to make the same decision. You release somebody into the prison population, and the prisoners and the guards are going to be your guinea pigs to see if you made the right decision. The way you find out is somebody gets injured or not.
Mr. Chair, well stated, and welcome to my world. Our prison staff deal with those decisions every day.
We'll make sure that everyone gets a copy of our restrictive housing paper.
Okay, no more questions. Go ahead, Commissioner.
We talked. Mr. Chair, I just do a time check here, please. How are we doing?
It's 11:05.
I don't know your agenda, if you have anybody else.
We go till noon.
Okay.
Very you bet. You're a good time.
We have, I talked about the volume of people coming in and the volume of people going out. This slide represents what we call the churn. And as previously stated, our St. Cloud facility is the facility that receives most of our offenders. Busloads arrive, and people when they see these numbers are amazed. And the bottom chart, I think, is another chart that maybe some of you folks have never seen before. But this shows the percentage of time that folks are with us in our prisons by gender. And, again, the vast majority of people are with us a very short time, which is pretty challenging when we consider what kind of programming we can offer, especially when we have people working in our industry programs. But and the pie chart, I have to correct immediately. You will see the word parole in the red area. That should be probation. And supervised, the release violator is the parole violator. That's the new term, supervised release. So if you just change parole to probation, everything is fine. But the important part of this pie chart, it gets to Chair Cornish's concern about returning people. We are very concerned about our supervised release violators, and community folks feed us the probation violators. So a district court has given a felon an opportunity to stay in a local facility. 95 or 97%, I think, of our felony sentenced people do time of some kind. Not everybody comes to prison. So the probation violators have done some violation of special conditions. Often they have been unable to maintain sobriety. They use drugs. They aren't complying with programming requirements. They may get a break or two on their probation, but eventually the judge says, time for you to go to prison. And that varies from district to district. Some districts have low tolerance for violators because they have no other programs. Some program-rich districts, judges may choose to use a local facility rather than send them to prison. But you can see between the release violators, supervised release violators, and the probation violators, we have thousands coming back who have been given an opportunity to succeed and have not chosen to do it. So we have recognized those two populations as focal points for our efforts. What can we do better in the community? What can we do better in supervision and addressing people's issues before they leave us so they don't return? And even, I guess enough said on that.
Commissioner, good point to bring a representative Ward in at this time then.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner and Deputy. Do we have any information? I mean, I would really like, I'm sure you do, I would like some information on what these violations are and if it's, how many of them are technical violations and what can we do to make that possible? I think we talked a year or so ago about the possibility of electronic check-ins instead of having people have to leave work or, you know, those complications, interruptions in life that make technical violations a real challenge.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, Ron Solheid, Deputy Commissioner of Community Services. The Hearings and Release Unit, which is in the Community Services Division, does track a lot of that information, so perhaps I can help with some of what occurs with release violators or technical release violators, as well as probation violators. But with our release violator population, it's important to note that the vast majority don't just have one violation. They typically come back for multiple violations. Oftentimes, about 50% of the time, it involves drug and alcohol use, either new criminal activity. Sometimes it's absconding from supervision. And I want to make sure that people know that offenders don't come back just for being late for a meeting with their agent. There are many immediate sanctions that agents will use to address technical violations before they bring anything to the Hearings and Release Unit for our release violators. So as example, in fiscal year 16, there were 2,700 individuals that were restructured. So as example, they were potentially maybe violating conditions of release. The agent would contact our hearings and release unit, and they would look for a restructure. So perhaps they're using drugs and alcohol. They will get them a chemical use assessment and direct the offender to follow the results of that assessment, whether it's inpatient or outpatient treatment. So that was 2,700 individuals that were restructured pre-hearing. They didn't even have a hearing, so that was just over the phone. We did have 4,300 hearings in fiscal year 16, and as you can see, there were approximately 2,800 release violators that came back. So oftentimes during the hearing process, a restructure may occur as well. It's important to note that, again, not everybody comes back initially on a technical violation. Oftentimes there are multiple violations before they would come back.
Here. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. 64% of your admissions are either release violators or probation violators. So they have been deemed okay to go back into the community, and they screw up. Couldn't we look at something a lot less costly than sending them back to prison? A hotel, for instance, with minimal security. I would be interested in what Representative Ward said, what the violations actually are, and if they're not person offenses, I think we could look at something that would be a lot cheaper and a lot more effective than sending them back to prison. Of course, if they're person violations, I would support them going back to prison, but 64% is an amazing number. And it would seem that a lot of them have been released, that they were considered to be able to go back into society, and they just keep messing it up. Thank you.
Comment on that, or should we go to Representative Hilsman?
Mr. Chair and Commissioner, do you know how many of these violators were for violent crime versus these property offenses?
Commissioner? Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, that's exactly the information that I referenced earlier that we're doing our comprehensive study on to show what type of violation, the demographics of the person that's violating, where they're from, and what strategies have been used prior to them violating. This slide maybe addresses some concerns raised here. And Deputy Solheid just discussed, we do our best to find alternatives other than prison. But you can see the profile of many of our offenders on this slide that eventually our options are very limited on what's available. Communities are not rich in resources, and if people in our custody that have these types of histories that are on this slide, it takes a pretty sophisticated program to get really to the root of the issue. And our population can be very challenging. We are working with some halfway houses. Last year, you folks had funding for two hub centers in our urban areas, which will people in the community will join on in a location. We got some halfway house enhancement money, but we believe there are strategies in the community that are effective and have pretty much the same results. But again, just to say, keep them out of prison, find something in the community. Some communities have nothing, especially in rural Minnesota.
Follow-up, Representative Hilsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we saw some slides in the prison population working group where there was a number of folks who were incarcerated for fifth-degree controlled substance who elected to execute their prison sentence. Do most of them elect to do that right at sentencing, or do they first come back as a violation and then elect to execute their sentence and then are they part of this 28%?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, I can't answer that question. I don't have the information with me. I think we can discern that.
I don't want to put words in Mr. Erdman's mouth in the back of there, but if I bet you I brought probation down here, we would find that it's very inconsistent across the state. I've got cops that are saying, what would this guy got to do, murder somebody before the probation officer will send him back? And then we got others that send him back for very technical violations. I imagine that's where we're going to find kind of like the inconsistencies in sentencing by judges statewide. But it'd be interesting to look at. We've chased this dog around the barn for several sessions and haven't been able to get a hold on it. So, Representative O'Neill, do you have something?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just back to the two-thirds that are coming through again that have not committed a new crime, and we were talking about how many of those were technical violations. When you provide the information to us, can you also provide how many of those were technical violations essentially because they've relapsed, because they have a dirty UI, they, you know, I have one instance of a constituent of mine who he had two DUIs. He was in his backyard with a beer, and the parole officer happened to stop by, and so now he's in prison again. So it would be helpful, I think, to try to get at the solutions if we understood the problem a little bit better and the difference between the technical violations, like the chair said, and, you know, a crime against a person being recommitted. But I'd like to know, like, how many of those technical violations are really just a symptom of their relapse.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, if I might also, I think it's important to note that a number of offenders that come back on technical violations oftentimes are our highest risk offenders. So the tolerance level for a technical violation for someone who's on intensive supervised release might have a very violent history is going to be lower. We look at that risk level as a part of the violation process. So while the violation itself may not have been a person-related offense, the individual may have been incarcerated for a severe person-related offense. So when they're using drugs or alcohol and not, you know, maintaining accountability with their agent, certainly we're going to take a look at that risk level and probably violate on that use condition. Just wanted to make that clear.
Kind of throw you a softball here. It would be fair to say that you folks are constantly looking at this, like the segregation policy, that you're open-minded and willing to look at changes? I mean, you don't look at this just once a year. I imagine you're constantly trying to monitor and massage it so you can come up with the right formula. Deputy?
Chairman Cornish, yes, you're right. In fact, in July of this year, we recently revised our hearings and release guidelines to look at issues directly related to the risk level of the offender that's involved, the violation that's involved, whether or not we have an opportunity to restructure. And we also looked at reducing the accountability time. We have a, much like the sentencing guidelines, we have a structured grid basically that looks at what is the time that's appropriate to come back for a particular violation. We just revised all of that in July, and we're now trying to track over this last 6 months what the impact has been.
Okay, Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to ask if you have an actual definition of technical violation, and if you don't, if you could define that when you get the information back to us, because I think depending on your point of view, something might be technical or maybe more closely related to a person-related issue.
Mr. Chair,
Commissioner,
Representative Becker-Finn, in the business, the description of there's two descriptions of violation, a new offense violation and a technical violation. Technical violations relate to all of those things that aren't related to a new crime.
Okay, and I guess
that's the simplest definition.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And Commissioner, I guess my point is, you know, like, you know, being caught with a beer is one thing, but having contact with someone maybe they're not supposed to have contact with, you know, my point was those are all technical violations, but they have different weight on the situation.
Well stated.
Okay, Commissioner, we got about 11 slides left to go, so go ahead.
This is, again, just another profile of people in prison.
This slide shows that the programming that we do in our correctional facilities, we want it to make a difference. And you can see that the rearrest, reconviction, and reincarceration rates for those who participate and complete our chemical dependency treatment programs, our education, and our challenge incarceration programs are greatly reduced because of their participation. And so we avoid costs related to that. The return on investment is good. It also holds true with our sex offender treatment programs.
We have very detailed research around all of these subject areas that are also on our website, and a number of these studies have received national attention. And you folks, I think, will soon see a report that was ordered last year called Results First, and that maybe you've seen it already, but that also verifies that the work we do makes a difference.
We are constitutionally required to provide health care for the offenders in our facilities, and so all of our facilities have an on-site clinic to deal with their day-to-day health care concerns. We do have 24-hour nursing at our Oak Park Heights, Faribault, and Shakopee facilities. And since 1998, we have had a contract with a private correctional health care vendor to provide primary care physicians, psychiatry, physical therapy, utilization management, and pharmacy. We have many challenges in the area of health care for our offender population. Many of the men and women who come into our system have not had good health care, gone to the doctor much, and taken care of themselves, and they've lived lives that take tolls on their bodies, and so you can see some of the challenges that we face. Within our prisons, we also have our MinCor Prison Industry Program. This is a program that benefits us in helping the offenders stay busy and get some realistic job skills training inside, and it also helps them as they're being released to have developed good work ethics and job skills so that they can get jobs upon release. The MinCor Industry Program also has a couple of components. One is called Employ and one is called Bridge, and they really help offenders with their transition to be successful, get that employment, do some job coaching. It's been very, very beneficial, and all at no additional cost to the taxpayers, because we are required to be self-sufficient with our MinCor prison industries. We operate in six facilities and have over 1,600 jobs. Our Office of Special Investigations is another very vital component of...
Sorry, Deputy. On the MinCor, how's it going in general? Have you dropped any contracts or picked up any new contracts or vendors?
Mr. Chair and members, our employment rate for our offenders remains very stable. We have picked up a few additional jobs, especially at our Bridge program at the MinCor headquarters in Roseville, where they have some men who are on work release status who are building up job skills and getting ready to be released. But honestly, the program is going really, really well, and our staff do a remarkable job finding people to bring business work into our prisons.
You're still making the big docks?
Mr. Chair, we are. We're doing that and a lot of other metal work.
Okay, thank you.
Like I said, our Office of Special Investigations plays a very vital role in our agency. They have three primary purposes. One is to conduct internal investigations in our facilities of inmate criminal activity. And our special investigators are very busy with intelligence gathering and security threat group monitoring and those kinds of things. We also play an important role of assistance to local law enforcement who is trying to resolve criminal activity in communities, because oftentimes our offenders in our prisons are tied to what's going on in the streets, and through mail monitoring and phone monitoring, we can really provide some very helpful assistance to local law enforcement. And then, of course, our fugitive apprehension unit, we have 12 sworn officers who are on the streets looking for people who have violated conditions of release, and they focus their efforts on the most serious violent offenders who are on supervision who have violated, those who are loss of life offenders, so who have killed someone else or are high level 3 sex offenders. They have good results and good records for finding those people fairly quickly.
Deputy, would this not only level 3, but would be for MSOP people too that might be out on, you know, there was outside the razor wire on visits and they abscond, or would that be taken care of by the SOP and MSOP?
Mr. Chair, the MSOP, the National Sex Offender Program of the Department of Human Services, has their own staff who do that. If the offender would be under our supervision yet through conditional release, we would have some role in that, and we work very closely with the MSOP staff.
And did you ever get those new officers all in place that we gave you, to get all trained in? And
Mr. Chair, it's been a busy FTO schedule for our special investigators, the fugitive staff, to get them trained in, and yes, we have, and it's much appreciated.
Sounds good.
Mr. Chair, I would emphasize that appreciation. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the next sections or the next slides are on the Community Services Division, and just kind of really quickly going through what Community Services does. The Department of Corrections provides supervision to approximately 20,000 offenders on probation, supervised release, and parole. We provide that felony level supervision in 54 counties, and in 28 of those counties in the state, we also provide misdemeanant and juvenile supervision for those offenders. This field services unit also supervises approximately in 75 counties. We supervise the offenders on intensive supervised release, and we provide supervision to all of the offenders releasing from the Challenge Incarceration Program statewide. We have a reentry unit within the Community Services Division, which provides our transition from prison to community efforts. Includes things like pre-release classes. Last year, I believe about 5,000 offenders went through pre-release classes. We have transition centers within all of our prisons that are staffed to assist offenders with finding community resources as they're releasing from prison. We have our risk assessment community notification unit, which is one that assigns risk levels to predatory offenders. Last year, I believe they held about 742 what we call end of confinement review committee meetings to assign risk levels to our most serious predatory offenders. And they manage a database with about 9,500 individuals that are assigned risk levels as predatory offenders. We have our inspection and enforcement unit, which inspects and licenses local jails, juvenile facilities, halfway houses that carry a correctional license. They inspect and license about 240-plus facilities, the majority of which are within the state. They also do some certifications on out-of-state juvenile facilities that house Minnesota juveniles. We have our hearings and release unit that we spoke a little bit about here recently. They conduct hearings, approximately 70 to 100 hearings per week around the state. We have to have those hearings in the counties where the alleged violation occurred. So they're a very busy unit, often traveling to county jails to have these hearings. We have our victim notification and restorative justice unit. That unit manages victim notification when offenders are changing custody levels or releasing from the facilities. We have about 9,000 plus individuals that are registered against offenders that are within our facilities that need to be notified when that individual reduces in custody classification or releases to the community. And then we have our grants and subsidies unit, which manages pass-through funding to counties, about $72 million a year, just under $72 million a year gets passed through to the Community Corrections Act counties and county probation offices for providing community supervision services, as well as some additional services that we manage. Outpatient sex offender treatment in the community is a portion of what they manage, and those resources are used by not only the DOC but the community corrections and county probation offices as well.
Representative Ward has a question, Deputy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Deputy, could you expand a little bit on restorative justice services and what that means? And I'm hoping that it's more than the offender having some money to give back to a victim.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward. I mean, our restorative justice unit provides a number of restorative justice services within our facilities, including things like victim offender dialogue, apology letters, maintaining an apology letter bank. They also provide opportunities for offenders during the holidays to provide gifts to their children who may still be, you know, in the community, so that there's that opportunity for interaction. They also, additionally, we manage a program within that unit called Minnesota Circles of Support and Accountability, or MNCOSA program, which recruits community volunteers to provide circles of support and accountability for offenders who have released into the community. So we have a variety of different programs and services through our restorative justice unit.
Okay, go ahead.
I think the next slide shows the total supervised release population. So when we talk about our probation population, which we'll get into in a little bit here, this is our offenders that are on supervised release. The Department of Corrections provides supervision to about 36% of this population, and the Community Corrections Act agencies provide supervision to about 64% of the supervised release population. Our next slide on releases from prison gives you some idea on that 6,480 individuals that are supervised within the state. 74% go out on supervised release, which would include, offenders releasing from prison. In some cases, you can see that a number of offenders are releasing on intensive supervised release, which is a service also provided under community supervision. Both Department of Corrections and our Community Corrections Act partners in some cases provide that level of supervision. Just real quickly, I know you've all seen this slide before about the three delivery systems within the department. We could get into a great deal of detail here, and I know that most people are fairly familiar with this, but if there's an opportunity in the future, certainly willing to meet with you and provide more information on how these delivery systems operate within the state. The next slide gives you a probation offender profile. As most of you know, felony probation is a court-ordered sentence that is a community alternative to prison and may include local jail time. As the commissioner mentioned, most offenders on felony probation who end up on felony probation do some local jail time. There are approximately 105,000-plus offenders on probation in Minnesota. The Community Corrections Act counties supervise about 72% of these individuals, Department of Corrections about 17%, and then the county probation offices about 11%. 85% of this group does not reoffend after 3 years. It's one of the recidivism statistics that we do maintain. And then it gives you a little bit more of the demographics on male, female, adult, and juvenile. The next graph represents the Minnesota total probation population from 2004 to 2015. And as you will see, the population on probation has decreased fairly significantly over the last several years. But I would caution and note that the reductions have been primarily in the areas of juvenile and misdemeanor and gross misdemeanor offenders. I think our community supervision agencies, both DOC and our county partners, are doing a good job, you know, working with the courts to reduce the number of individuals on probation that are low-level misdemeanants and juveniles through a variety of different programs that have been offered at the county level.
Commissioner, Representative Hilstrom has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. Does the Department of Corrections have a early discharge program from probation? If so, is that something that's on a case-by-case basis, or do you have a policy about that? And are you seeing an increase in early discharge if you have one, or less discharge early?
Deputy?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hilstrom, the Department of Corrections does have a policy regarding early discharge. All early discharge from probation, whether it's the Department of Corrections or our county partners, goes through the court system, so it's up to the judicial districts as to whether or not they're going to release early. We recently did a study or a report that was directed by the last session regarding earned credit compliance. As a part of that report, which was provided to both the House and the Senate here, there is information regarding early discharge, and I would note that I believe about 40% of individuals who are serving a year or more on probation are discharged early. So all of the Department of Corrections counties are under one early discharge policy. Various community corrections agency and county probation offices have early discharge policies, and those are typically informed by prosecutors and the bench within the district where they're located.
Representative Ward.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. And Deputy, I wanted to thank you for your comments and explanations about the restorative justice services. My experience is primarily at the county level, but understanding that especially the circles of support and accountability have such success, I'm interested in what we can do to expand on that, to build on that. How do you recruit volunteers? Are you talking about the community services, so county level? And there used to be a restorative justice department in the Department of Corrections. But I think that that's been not only when it was disbanded, it was such a solid thing that people had incorporated it in their daily work a lot, I think. And so it's become a little bit more the philosophy of restoring people to the community in a really healthy way. So how can we work on expanding that? Because if I understand it right, and my experience is that recidivism really goes down, and that's had a huge impact on that juvenile number.
Deputy.
Mr. Chair, Representative Ward, you are correct. We did have a restorative justice unit at one point in time, specific at the Department of Corrections, although through some funding cuts and reductions that was reduced. Currently, our MNCOSA program really has a director and one staff person. In essence, it's a lead person and a staff person. We focus primarily three different targeted populations: level two sex offenders, veterans, and also our lifers releasing from prison. We try to develop circles of support and accountability for those that are in the community. Our impact is very limited. Our research has shown that this has been very positive. There's a great return on investment for reducing recidivism within this group, with our studies on MNCOSA has shown that. In order to expand it would require some additional staff, because recruiting and retaining volunteers is extremely labor intensive. Lead worker there, Kevin Nelson, does an excellent job recruiting volunteers through faith-based communities, colleges, and other community organizations. But again, it's limited with the impact that they can have.
Okay. Go ahead and move through the slide.
Quickly then, getting to the probation offense categories, you can see our felony level probation offenders account for really the largest number, which adhering to evidence-based practices, one would expect that that would be the case. And as I said, our reductions have been primarily in the gross misdemeanor, and juvenile areas over the last several years, although our felony probation numbers over the last since 2010 have been increasing as opposed to decreasing.
Mr. Chair, I would add to this slide, there is some good news here, and that's particularly in the juvenile world. 10 years ago, there was over 14,000 kids on probation. And you can see the pretty significant, really incredible reduction. And when I give that statistic, then everybody says, well, why? And I wish I had a great answer. I think the why is maybe that we are doing better as a society. There's emphasis in schools, social service departments, family work. I think people are really looking at the future of our society as in our kids and we're putting emphasis there, which I think is really, really important. I got a couple grins the other day when I made this presentation to the Senate committee, and I made the comment that being bad maybe just isn't as cool as it used to be. I think generally kids are more positive in their approach to life, and those kids that are getting into trouble just aren't the models that maybe existed years ago. And so we hope that these reduced juvenile numbers will someday translate to lower adult numbers. We think, and I'm knocking on wood that that comes true, and so investing in kids is a great idea.
Representative Ward has a question, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Commissioner, it's really more to maybe have a little addendum to your comments about youth. I think that today's youth have some additional challenges there, whether it's drugs, the family, the mental health issues, all the kinds of things that we are dealing with as a society. And I've been following this for a long time, too, particularly youth programs, and very grateful for the youth intervention programs that we have. I think they've made a huge impact on our youth who are headed down a path that would lead them to prison. So I want to also thank the committee for their support and the legislature as a whole for support for the youth intervention programs so they don't end up in our prisons. And there has been a national trend for declining youth problems, well, probably since about 2005 was when they really started noticing a decline, and people said, I don't know why, you know, what's happening. But that was also a time when there was some increased growth in youth intervention programs. So that's, you know, I think we have a lot of things to be grateful for, and that's one of them that I am. Thanks.
Commissioner. Mr. Chair, committee members, we'll close with this slide, that we continue to believe that the work we do in programming in our facilities, in our communities under supervision, that our county partners provide, we are making a difference, and the difference is in better humans, better citizens, but I think also, we are being responsible in terms of how we are spending the public money. I have not been approached by one politician to say, can I use corrections as my campaign platform? I get that. I hate the fact that our society has to spend so much on an issue that is not really something we can hold out and say we are really, really making a difference. It's tough to make the case that we are improving the lives of others, and I sure hope that you believe our research. I sure hope that you have confidence that our Department of Corrections is under good leadership, and we're being good stewards of the public funds. And every day I'm very proud to say that I lead a department of great people who have committed their lives to a task that not many people stand up to do. So I look forward to working with you. Our department looks forward for future presentations, and thank you very much for this moment in time.
Well, Commissioner, we have a couple of thank you very much, and we have a couple of representatives' questions. But first, you might have covered this. How many deaths do you have a year of prisoners in the correction system a year in our state prisons? And then the other question would be, to what lengths can we go to keep people alive? Not that we shouldn't. I'm just saying, what measures are you able to do for, like, a quality of life, or if somebody is, like, dialysis or cancer, what lengths can you go to legally, or how are you bound liability-wise?
Mr. Chair, our medical director happens to be in the room, and she is recognized around the country as an expert in correctional health, and I think she can answer those questions way better
then
than
after
I can.
After that, Representative Considine and Representative Johnson have a question. Go ahead, ma'am.
Morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Nan Larson. I'm the Health Services Director for the Department. Thank you, Commissioner, for those kind words. We have somewhere between 14 and 20 deaths per year, and probably our most frequent cause of death is liver cancer, so hepatitis kinds of issues, and then that's followed behind other kinds of cancers, and heart disease, so about 14 to 20. We do have the capacity to treat dialysis. We have an in-house dialysis unit. There's currently 8 chairs that we have there, and we are serving almost 17 offenders who have dialysis needs. That's saving us a ton of money in off-site transportation and security costs, because obviously if you're in dialysis 3 times a week, so 2 officers with you for those 3 to 4 hours 3 times a week. So our in-house dialysis unit is really very cost-effective for us. We're pretty much able to treat anything that is thrown at us when it comes to offender conditions. The things that we can't treat are things like ventilator-dependent offenders, for example. But we get all sorts of conditions that we end up treating. I think there was some question earlier about maybe we talked a little bit about a conditional medical release. If we find that we can't treat something internally and we can't manage that condition, we'll probably look to a conditional medical release for that offender. But oftentimes it's difficult to find that. The commissioner mentioned our Linden unit. It's a 100-bed unit at our Faribault facility. That's one of the units where we have 24-hour nursing. And that's kind of like our geriatric unit. So it's offenders that need 24-hour nursing care, so coronary artery disease, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, some paraplegics, quadriplegics will be there, but they don't need kind of that subacute level of care that we have at our Oak Park Heights facility in the transitional care unit.
When it gets down into the last days of a person's life, you're like hospice, are you able to be flexible with your visiting hours to allow the person not to die alone?
Mr. Chair, that's a really good question. We do have a really good hospice program, and right now it's located specifically at our transitional care unit at Oak Park Heights. And, yes, we allow the family to come in. We actually shut that unit down and allow the family to come in to have deathbed visits when an offender is nearing death. And we're actually looking at expanding it to our Faribault unit just because it is so hard to shut down that entire unit.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Then Representative Considine and Representative Johnson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not a question. I hope that the one thing that we will all go away with today is if the commissioner had more help, mental health resources, we could cut into the solitary seclusion, but we would also really improve officer safety. So I think that's something we should look at. Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Roy, there's actually three slides I'd like to talk about or ask questions about. First one is slide number three, when talks about the deficient and effective. On the last bullet point, I didn't hear you talk about it, but it states that 10 out of 11 programs show a positive return on taxpayer investment. I'm not going to ask which one does not, but I was just wondering if you'd consider, if that program's not working, taking the funding from that program and moving it to programs that actually work for a better investment on our tax dollars.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, we have a very similar interest in identifying programs that don't work, and it's foolish to do things that don't work. I agree. The challenge that we have in that regard, however, is not everything we do is translatable to actual dollars. For instance, we might have a program that builds character within the prison population. That building of character and positive traits may translate to fewer discipline procedures. And it's hard to quantify dollar-wise. We know they're making an impact in mellowing out the population, but how to put a dollar amount on that, it's very difficult. So we sure, and the reason we do the research is to do exactly what you have identified. And you had two other slides?
Commissioner, or Representative.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, yes, two other slides. One is, I'll just go over both of them real quick. Slide number eight talks about the number of individuals that are in the being housed in the county jails right now. I do know that you have the reentry programs, and I believe, from what I've heard in the past, these individuals that are being housed in the county jails are not being able to participate in the reentry programs that they have in the prison system. I'm just wondering if you can get back to me or to the committee, what percentage of those that are in the county jails are reoffending and reentering, either reoffending or doing violations of conditions of release, so they're going back into the system, compared to those that go through the reentry programs. And then again on slide 17, same type of deal with reentry. But I was wondering, of the 5,135 that reenter the system on either as part of the release, are those total number of individuals or total number of times somebody's come back into the system? Because I'm wondering how many times individuals come back multiple times and in and out, in and out, in and out. Is that counted as one or is counted as three?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that will be a part of our analysis, and you've identified something that's real common in corrections statistics, is do you count incidents or do you count offenders? And with your background, you know that those can be very different. A small number of individuals can produce a lot of incidents. And we'll get that to you as soon as Deputy Solheid gets it done.
It's on the list.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. You did a good use of your time, and we'll save the real hot seat grilling questions for your budget overview. So we'll look forward to seeing you again. So thank you much.
Thank you, committee member.
Meeting adjourned.